Windows Server 2008 R2. Top 10 features that you'll actually care about. Hello, my name is Greg Shields, and I'm a Microsoft MVP as well as a partner with Concentrated Technology. And over the next few minutes, I want to spend a little bit of time talking with you about Windows Server 2008, and specifically the R2 release. You know, you've probably been reading about all the new features and functionality that you get with this new release of the Microsoft Server operating system, but really figuring out which of those things are really interesting to you, which are the ones that are really going to compel you towards an upgrade, can actually be kind of a difficult process. And so I've been asked to actually present to you kind of the top 10 features that you really will actually care about when it comes to Windows Server 2008 R2. Now, before we actually get into those top 10 features, what I want to do is spend a little bit of time and talk about the upgrade itself, or the new operating system itself. Now, if you've been around for any period of time, you know that Microsoft has actually released two of these R2 operating system updates. The first was Windows Server 2003 R2. Now, there's a big difference between that Windows Server 2003 R2 and what we're seeing with the 08 R2. If you remember back a few years ago, Windows Server 2003 R2 arrived as a kind of a disk 2 to the original Windows Server 2003 installation. And if you had a Server 03 installation, you could install that disk 2 and it would add a bunch of things over the top of that 03 installation. Now, in that way, you could almost think of the first R2, that 03 R2, as kind of a feature pack almost. It included some new capabilities, it added a few new services, and honestly, a lot of the services that it added were things that not a lot of us really used. And so for a lot of us, we kind of skipped the original R2 with Server 2003. Now, Server 2008 R2 is a completely different animal than the original version. It's a completely different operating system than the original version. Windows Server 2008 arrives as a completely new OS, and so it's got some kernel improvements in there. It's got some low-level optimizations in there that make it a completely different OS, and thus you're going to be going through a full upgrade process to actually go from 08 to 08 R2. Now, the other important point about 08 R2 is Windows Server 2008 is the last operating system that Microsoft will release in 32-bit. R2 is only available in x64. This means that if you have servers in your environment today that don't support x64, well, those servers are quickly going to become end of life because this is the last operating system that Microsoft has said they will support. And so when you move to R2, be aware that you have to have x64 on those servers to be able to make use of that operating system. Now, with this in mind, let's actually take a look at 10 of the features, 10 of the specific new capabilities that are in R2 that you're actually going to want to use. You know, as I said before, there are a lot of them out there, but these are going to be 10 that should really compel your upgrade to this new operating system. We'll start with number one. Now, I'm a remote desktop services MVP. This is what my MVP is in. And so obviously, I've got to make RDS the number one of all of these. Now, they're not necessarily in any particular order, but this is the first new feature that I think you really ought to take a look at. Because terminal services moved remote desktop services adds a lot of neat, nifty functionality, most specifically if you have Windows 7 as your desktop environment. Now, a couple of these, and I'm just picking out the most important of these features. The first is remote app and desktop connection, which, if you're familiar with Citrix Metaframe or Citrix ZenApp, you're familiar with that little client that would actually go up to a Citrix server and bring down all the applications automatically, and so it would put those applications on the start bar or on the desktop for you. Well, Microsoft has brought some of that technology into the Windows operating system with Windows 7 with this remote app and desktop connection. Using that client will automatically go out to a server somewhere that hosts an XML file and pull down all those applications links so you can actually make a single-click access to your remote apps out in your environment, and it's automatically updated. Of course, it does require Windows 7 at the client, but this makes the process of connecting to your remote desktop services, remote apps, much easier for your clients. Now, even if you don't have Windows 7, one of the new features with RDS that's very cool and is something that we have been looking for, we RDS admins have been looking for a very long time, is this concept of fair share CPU scheduling. Now, back in the old days, back in the original Windows Server 2008, we could actually have one user, and you've probably experienced this, where one user did something very bad. Maybe they tried to compile some code or run a GIS application or do something that involved a lot of the CPU on that server. And when one user would use too much CPU, well, it would obstruct the user experience of all those other users on that server. Well, no more with R2. R2 includes this capability called Fair Share CPU Scheduling, which is really, really cool in the way it operates. All of the available users on that server are limited to an equal share of the available CPU, and this is a proactively based solution. So when one user uses 100% of their processing power, they're really only using, if there's 10 users on that server, they're really only using the 10% of the total use. And so no single user can oversubscribe that CPU resources and prevent them from use by the other users. That's a really useful tool and actually makes RDS much, much easier to use and much easier to manage than some of the older versions. And lastly, we also have this thing called Remote Desktop Virtualization, which is essentially Microsoft's first foray into the VDI space or into this concept of hosted desktops. Now, I'll tell you that Remote Desktop Virtualization has got a lot of pieces and parts, but if you have the servers and if you have the desire to create a hosted desktop environment, you can build together today with simply instances of Windows Server 2008 R2, your own VDI, your own hosted desktop environment. And really, this happens through an expansion of what we call the session broker. It used to be called the Terminal Services Session Broker, now it's called the RD Session Broker. That same session broker allows you to not only load balance your different remote app applications, but also your individual desktop connections, your individual hosted desktops as well. Now, this is the first of the 10 tools. There are 9 other different features that we want to talk about here, the second of which is Hyper-V itself. Now, with Hyper-V, Hyper-V has got a lot of press, and I'm sure you've been spending a lot of time looking at Hyper-V and looking at the different feature comparisons between Hyper-V and its competitors. But really, with R2, Hyper-V gains 2 specific features that give it new levels of resiliency that make it worthwhile for the enterprise. The first of which is this live migration. Back with Windows Server 2008, to actually complete a migration from one host to the other of a virtual machine, the process to complete that involved a little bit of downtime, a few seconds, maybe upwards of a minute. That minute was really something that a lot of environments couldn't swallow. And so Microsoft updated in R2 the capability to bring us live migration, just like what some of the competitors for Hyper-V have, meaning the zero downtime migration of virtual machines from cluster node to cluster node. Now, another of the real limitations with Hyper-V in the version 1 instance was the inability for you to really put more than one virtual machine on a connected LAN. You could, but when you had to fail over that virtual machine, all the other virtual machines on that LAN had to fail over at the same time. The reason for this was because in a clustered environment, the cluster resource has to be failed over at once, and that cluster resource was the actual disk or the connected LAN. Now, in R2, R2 actually has some very brilliantly designed piece of code called Cluster Shared Volumes that actually adds cluster awareness to the existing NTFS file system that we're used to seeing. You're familiar with NTFS. It's not a new file system. It's not something you have to install and change your operating process. All Cluster Shared Volumes does is layer over the top of NTFS and allows the different nodes in your cluster to arbitrate for the individual files that are on that connected LAN. What this means is that a virtual machine, if there are multiple virtual machines on a LAN, one virtual machine can be moved over from one host to the other, leaving the other virtual machines there. It's really cluster awareness for NTFS. Now, a couple of other new cool capabilities. Obviously, we have Hyper-V Server R2, which is arguably one of the worst named solutions, but one of the greatest solutions in terms of cost. If you're afraid to actually move to Hyper-V because of some of the cost, consider Hyper-V Server, which is a completely free instance of really Windows Server Core that includes all the functionality of original Hyper-V, including the high availability features. This is something that the other competitors don't necessarily have because they want you to pay for those high availability features. Another of the features, too, is called Second Level Address Translation, or SLAT. And what SLAT does is SLAT allows Hyper-V to make use of some processor optimizations on the motherboards, if your motherboards actually support those processor optimizations, that have a dramatic speed improvement for certain workloads. So while Hyper-V has all kinds of different features, the two that you really need to be conscious of are this live migration feature and this cluster shared volumes feature, because these two capabilities really make Hyper-V ready for the enterprise. Number 3 has to do with direct access. And direct access really means always on access. If you're like me and you hate that when you go out to the coffee shop or you go out to the hotel or the airport, you have to use the VPN client of some form to actually connect into your environment, or if you've had to troubleshoot your users and their VPN clients as they're trying to get in. You know that VPN clients do not really mean always on access. It means sometimes on access. So Microsoft has spent a lot of time and effort in actually developing a product that allows users to be, quote, on the LAN, even when they're not. Now, what this means is that applications, file access, email updates, configuration management, all of those normal things that you would do while you're on the LAN are all always on when your computers leave that LAN. Now think about this. If they go out to a coffee shop, or if they go out to a hotel, or if they go out to the airport, they can still make use of all the applications that are installed to their desktop or their laptops just as if they were plugged in at home. And you could manage them just as if they were plugged in at home. Now, this is kind of cool from an access standpoint, but there are obviously some security concerns there, and it may raise the hackles in the back of your neck, the hairs in the back of your neck, because of some of those obvious security concerns, the idea of split tunneling between where they're connected in and where they are on your LAN. Now, obviously, Microsoft would not have built a solution like Direct Access if it didn't include all of those needed things for security, encryption, authentication, enforcement, and even IPv6. Now, Direct Access has a great return. There's a great return in terms of optimizing and making things easier for your users, but it can be a challenging implementation because of all those security things that need to get put in place to make this function. It requires the integration of a lot of different pieces and different protocols that you may not have heard of before. And so, but take a look at Direct Access, because it alone has the capability of dramatically changing how your users operate with your LAN when they're away from your LAN. Now, another capability that you may have heard a little bit about is this branch cache feature. And unlike Direct Access, which is a little painful to install, branch cache is a really easy solution. And branch cache, I've said before in some of my writing, that branch cache may be one of those solutions, one of those new features, that may be a dramatic reason or a substantial reason why you may want to move to Windows 7, because branch cache requires Windows 7 at the client. Now, with branch cache, your branch office users, those that are way out in another part of the world connected with a slow network connection, don't have to be second-class citizens anymore. Because they're on the other side of that latent network connection, they don't have to have that slow process of transferring files from the main office to the branch office. Because what branch cache does is it actually caches documents at the local site at the point they're first accessed. Now, obviously, we have to transfer that document over one time, but then the changes can get transferred over in chunk little bytes. There's no longer the need after you transfer it the first time to transfer that full document over the wire. Now, this is particularly cool, and I really, really, really like the way in which Microsoft has implemented this, because Microsoft has really said we are putting this together as a set it and forget it sort of implementation. Once you've enabled branch cache, your clients are automatically redirected to local copies with no change whatsoever to their user behavior. Your users simply go and do whatever they need to do, go find the documents they need to find, and they will automatically be redirected to a local version of that document if it is available locally. You don't even have to have servers at your branch offices. You can actually use the various desktops in that branch office as a cache host. Now, with disk drives being the way they are these days, there's plenty of space on those disk drives. So, you know, adding a little bit of space to host some copies of documents isn't that bad. And the processing power is relatively small on those desktops as well. So you don't have to spend money to actually implement this. More importantly, though, this service operates at a level below HTTP and the SMB protocol. What this means is that your existing applications as well can automatically use it with no changes. Your HTTP applications, anything that uses SMB, will automatically be redirected with no changes to those applications. And you can secure that cache using a solution like EFS or BitLocker if you want to further lock down those files to prevent those from being used by prying eyes. Branch cache, really, really, really cool feature, and one that you're definitely going to want to implement if you have branch offices. Number 5, AppLocker, really turns the concepts of conventional security wisdom all on its head. Think about how we've done security for very, very long. We've installed anti-malware. We've installed antivirus. We've installed all these anti-everything solutions that reactively sort of clean up situations after bad things happen, right? You know, once the virus is already on the computer, then that anti-malware then cleans it off. But the problem with all of these anti-anything solutions is that they're always an after-the-fact solution. On the other hand, AppLocker becomes more of a before the fact solution. What you get with AppLocker when you use AppLocker in the combination of R2 and Windows 7 is a whitelist of applications. This whitelist of applications effectively determines which applications are allowed to execute in your environment. Which exes, which DLLs, if you want to go that far, can actually be executed in your environment. Each operating system, each desktop, each laptop, each server will verify against that whitelist before they actually execute any code. If it's not on the whitelist, it's simply not executed. What this does is it eliminates many forms of malware execution because, well, unless you're doing something wrong, you're probably not going to put malware on your whitelist. It also eliminates those inappropriate apps. If somebody's downloading Kazaa or any of those applications that you don't want on your network, you can prevent those from being accessed because they're simply not, again, not on that whitelist. There are many ways that you can select which applications are there. You can do it by path. You can do it by file hash. You can do it even by publisher so that different versions of that same file are automatically approved when the publisher releases updates. AppLocker in R2, fantastically big improvements to this solution. We even have a monitor only mode now that allows you to just monitor the applications in your environment so that you know that you will make sure that you have the right applications on your whitelist before you turn it on. Believe you me, there's nothing worse than having the CEO's application that they need and only they have that's not on your whitelist when they need to make use of it. So AppLocker and R2, definitely take a look at it. This is feature number 5. Feature number 6 is the file classification infrastructure. And is one feature that I don't believe is getting a lot of press in the blogosphere these days and in the IT press locations these days. But FCI has some really neat capabilities for your environment to help you classify your files and help you do something with those files based off of their classification. Now, let's think about this for a second, right? We Windows admins have not traditionally been content administrators. Our job is to keep the servers running. Our job is to keep the data secure, but it's not necessarily to read the data and verify that the right people have the right data. Generally, if the file's in the right folder, then that's all we care about. But the requirements of security and the requirements of regulatory compliance are really changing our jobs. They're really requiring us to be content administrators. Now, until just recently, until FCI, there were not really great tools out there for us to be able to identify what sorts of content were on our file servers. Think about this. If you have a very secret project, we'll call it Project X. And Project X, for example, any time that a document has the words Project X into it, you want to have that document protected in a certain way. Maybe you want it deleted after 12 months. Maybe you want it moved to a certain folder. Maybe you want a special labeling put on that document. It's something different when it has that word Project X in it. Now, if you were told you had to do this without some sort of tool, you'd have to go and scan every single document in your environment to see if that word was in there. Well, that's what FCI does. FCI allows you to classify those documents based on where they're located, if this document is in this folder, or what sorts of content is in them. Do they include the text Project X? And if they include that text Project X, put a label on that document that now follows that document wherever it goes. So if that document moves to another file server or to a laptop or a desktop somewhere in your environment, that label will stick with it. And you can use FCI to manage those labeled documents as a group using scripts or actions or whatever tools you want. Now, this combination of classification and then being able to do stuff with those classified documents means that you can better protect your environment against those data loss incidents, which can be very, very painful for you. So definitely take a look at FCI. It's even extendable to include third-party solutions to add further features and functionality. But the basic things you can do with FCI, very remarkable and very cool solution by Microsoft. Number 7 is BitLocker. Now, BitLocker is not new. BitLocker's been around for a while. But BitLocker for your servers, and particularly your branch office servers, suddenly becomes a compelling sort of architecture because BitLocker in R2 now has the capability of encrypting more than just the system drive. Now, with the early versions of BitLocker, you could only encrypt the C drive, the system drive, the drive where the OS was installed onto it. And that's great, except for most of us put our data in other locations. So Microsoft realized their omission, and with R2 now supports the encrypting of all drives. I'll tell you, there are two great solutions for this. One is obviously those remote office servers, right? Do you have a file server out at that remote office? Is that file server behind locked doors, or is it sitting underneath the desk of the administrative assistant? Those semi-protected servers can now be protected against theft because you can BitLocker them. If somebody takes them off the network, they cannot be hacked. I mean, it's functionally impossible for them to be hacked at this point. Also, BitLocker to Go supports the encryption of removable drives. So if you have a removable drive, if you have USB sticks that get plugged in, you can, through group policy, actually enable greater security by requiring those drives to be encrypted. And this just makes your process of securing that data even easier. Number eight is IIS, and IIS has made a few moderate improvements. I know a lot of us are accidental IIS administrators. And for those of us that are accidental IIS administrators, there are a couple of great improvements. The IIS manager has got some new functionality that makes it easier for us to manage it through the GUI. If you are a developer or if you are someone who is actually using IIS to create web pages, we now have the IIS PowerShell provider, which improves management of the command line. If you're using Server Core, which I don't believe many of us are doing with IIS, at least right now, R2 includes the support of .NET in Server Core, which means you're going to be able to support more kinds of websites. We now have configuration logging, which allows us to verify when things have changed and how they got changed. We have a dedicated best practice analyzer to ensure that you're doing the right things with your website. And we've now integrated URL Scan 3.0. We call it the Request Filter module. Again, moderate improvements with IIS, but definitely ones that are desired for by IIS administrators. Number nine is power consumption. Now, this is not necessarily something you're directly going to see in your OS, but buried deeply under the covers is this new technology called Core Parking. Core Parking allows the Windows operating system, when it identifies that there's not a lot of processing going on, right? Maybe it's the end of the day. Maybe it's the middle of the night, and there's just not much going on that server. Well, Windows can automatically shift the threads that are being processed across all of its cores to a smaller number of cores and shut down those cores when the processing is light. You can also, there's actually some changes to this P-state configuration that reduces power consumption by reducing CPU capacity, right? The combination of these two capabilities, which again happen automatically once you've enabled them, can really reduce the amount of power that you're consuming during periods of time that you're not really using those servers. Now again, you have to enable Core Parking. There's a command line you're going to use to actually enable it. But once you enable it, all the real meat of Core Parking actually occurs in the background. A couple of another smaller features. There's a new power namespace, /sim v2/power. And that's going to enable you PowerShell scripters, you VBScript scripters, you people who have monitoring solutions. Those people with monitoring solutions and scripts will be able to monitor and react to power conditions on those servers. So you'll definitely be able to have a better sense of the power consumption in your environment and do things based off of what you're reading out of that power consumption. And also, there's been a slight expansion of power-oriented group policy settings. If you haven't yet taken a look at the power-oriented group policy settings, especially if you've moved to Vista or even Windows 7 by now, although very few of you have at this point, you really might take a look at those group policy settings so that you can reduce your total amount of power in your environment today. And most importantly, power plans are now remotable too, so you can actually use WMI to remote those power plans if you want. Number 10 has to do with management. And number 10 is great for all of us Windows admins out there. PowerShell and Server Manager both gain new awesome features, new awesomeness. PowerShell with R2 is installed and available by default. And so the presence of a PowerShell runtime is really no longer a concern on those target systems. Now, this is important because PowerShell is now fully remotable. That means you can use a PowerShell command against another computer, which is something that was always difficult to do. You could always remote a WMI, but you could never necessarily remote remote PowerShell commands. And there are also more PowerShell commandlets. Microsoft is continuing its support of making everything PowerShell aware. IIS, remote desktop services, Active Directory, group policy, everything these days has PowerShell commandlets for it. If you haven't yet learned PowerShell, now is the time, because PowerShell version 2 is when everything gets really, really cool. And then lastly, Server Manager can now remote other servers. Hooray! Microsoft has heard from us, they've heard what we've wanted, and really made Server Manager a useful tool so that we can remote other servers in our environment. Those, my friends, are 10 features that you will actually care about in Windows Server 2008 R2. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. I look forward to helping you and to seeing you successfully upgrade to Windows Server 2008 R2. Once again, my name is Greg Shields, and I'm a partner with Concentrated Technology. Have a great day.